Huey Newton fled the country to Cuba in 1974, Elaine Brown became the only woman to ever lead the Black Panther Party. She did so until 1977. On this edition of Conversations, a conversation with former Panther Elaine Brown. Her book is called A Taste of Power, A Black Woman's Story. We'll talk to her about her life and times, and life and times with the Black Panther Party. Please join us. I'm Susan McGinnis, your host for Conversations. Elaine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
When the men of the Black Panther Party first took to the streets, my understanding of what they felt they were doing is that they wanted to convince the police to obey the law, which they felt the police weren't doing. And they wanted to convince poor Black people that they could stand up for themselves. Is that a fair characterization of those early days?
It's pretty fair. There weren't just men, by the way. There were some women, amazingly, who were in those patrols, and those early patrols in 1966, and who even went to Sacramento, the famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, invasion of Sacramento by Black Panther Party members, which was a small group of people in the, as we know now, or realize now, but it looked very big at the time. Excuse me. We had at that time, the party had a 10-point platform and program, but the seventh point had to do with police repression. And we felt that that was the immediate, most immediate problem in the Black community of Oakland and everywhere. Interestingly, we have Rodney King now, so we know that obviously that wasn't in our minds. So therefore, I think that it did have exactly what you said, a twofold purpose. We punched up point number seven to begin the long program to satisfy the 10-point program and platform, which ultimately led to the concept of revolution in America. But that we had to start somewhere, and that was a dramatic point. It was effective. It had something to do with getting rid of fear among Black people. It had something to do with forcing the police to deal with the, at least the law as it stood, and the way that they treated Black people on the streets of Oakland. When we had the shotguns, it definitely had an impact on the minds of the police and the people.
The laws about weapons at that time were that one wasn't allowed to carry a concealed weapon, which permitted people to carry revealed weapons. And the Panthers took advantage of that.
We used that. But really, it was, we just used it. I mean, we carried shotguns. I mean, I think it was illegal to carry a handgun, but not a shotgun. Isn't America a wonderful country?
Right.
And so we did. That's what we carried. That's what the members of the party carried at that time, were pump shotguns. It's pretty impressive, though, to see on the street.
Very scary.
For the police. Yeah. Because they didn't have shotguns in their hands. They had 38 revolvers.
People who have not been raised in the poorest parts of the United States will not have a sense of what it was like when you say there was only police law in the ghettos. What does that mean?
Well, the clearest way to explain it would be the Rodney King case. We all saw that. That went around the world, the videotape of Rodney King. Mm-hmm. And if you saw it, you know, despite the jury's eyes, I think that anybody with half a brain would figure out the 27 cops. There were not four, there were 27. Because he resisted arrest. According to their description, and he was beaten on the ground with handcuffs and everything else. This was so common, everybody Black, and certainly a lot of Latinos living in so-called barrios in California, Puerto Ricans in New York and so forth, know that there was no business of presenting a warrant to come into your house. You kick in the door, you enter the house, that's the end of that. And nobody even asked about it because you knew that the law was you had a gun. It wasn't much point in arguing with the point of a gun. Mm-hmm. So I think that whether you realize what was happening then or not, if you just use the Rodney King example to realize that there are so many Rodney Kings going on even now, it's just that they're publicized because we now have video cameras, which we didn't have in those days. But lots and lots of kids, I mean, you'd have not just young Black men, but girls too, rousted on the street, people going into their houses, oh, I think you got drugs in there. Just arbitrary, complete Wild West operation. Out of control, and Black people terrified to even comment on it. What are you going to do? Go down to the police and file a police report? And right. So we changed the nature of that relationship, at least at the time, and in every city that we had a Black Panther Party chapter, or in every state, we did the same thing.
What's the legacy of the Black Panthers on that issue?
Well, it's a sad situation because I don't know that there is one. There is still a lot of fear in the Black community. I mean, I talked to some brothers, we call, as I say, brothers, Black young men in Los Angeles, who were former Crips or why can't I think of this, Bloods
yeah.
which is really a lot of gangs under one aegis or two aegises. And some of them said they were no longer in the gangs because there was a truce going on. But you know, we always had gangs in the Black community and in other communities too, Italian communities, Irish communities. They all had gangs. So this is not really a phenomenon. But I asked them. I said, well, you know, you tore up half of Los Angeles, and you had four cops on trial, and you tore up Los Angeles because the four cops were acquitted. I'm trying to figure out why you thought they wouldn't be acquitted and what was surprising to you. And I'm also trying to figure out why you expect to have the very system of justice that is a part of which the police are a part and parcel that will condemn the police for doing what they've been doing all along. So if there had been a Black Panther Party around, there wouldn't have been a Rodney King case in the same way that there had been. It just wouldn't have happened. Even the LAPD, for example, will acknowledge that when there was a Black Panther Party, there were no gangs. They only had to deal with Black people in general, but they didn't have that gang warfare. Mm-hmm. So we had an impact, and that impact has just really gone away. There is fear. And they all looked at me. I said, because you're armed. You're 80,000 armed gang members in L.A. Four cops just walked out of Simi Valley Courthouse, and all you did was get mad and tear up, trash some grocery stores or whatever other little stuff that was. I was very unimpressed by it, and I said that I was unimpressed. And they were surprised. I said, you want to talk about the Black Panther Party in the swashbuckling mode, the berets and the guns that you've seen on posters and
the romantic
role. Yeah. We've had people that were killed, but I know that we wouldn't have had Rodney King in our day. So you need to regroup and think about whether you really want to get down with the revolution as you know that kind of romantic rhetoric from that 60s era.
What's the difference between the rage and anger that you see in the ghetto now and the power that the Black Panthers had then?
Well, there was direction. I mean, we had an agenda. There's focus has been lost. People are angry and they are conscious. They know what the problems are, basically, and they know where they're coming from. And the problems are far worse. The conditions under which Black people are living today are far worse than in the 60s and far worse than even in the 40s. It's incredible. The poverty is overwhelming. The difference between the rich and the poor in general in America is overwhelming, more overwhelming than 15 or 20 years ago, thanks to the Reagan era, for example, where tax cuts, you know, made the rich richer and the rest. So I think that in terms of the legacy of the party and what we had to do with that, the consciousness is there. There's just no focus. And so what I'm trying to do with my book and with a school program that I'm trying to initiate is to try to get some focus back into the Black community in terms of agenda. People are running around, is it rap records? What's our problem? Is it Farrakhan? Do we like him or don't we? I mean, these are the kind of, Michael Jackson, is he guilty or innocent? Mm-hmm. I mean, these are MTV conversations, you know? It's like, why don't we just talk about the whatever her name is, Harding, and Kerrigan or something. I mean, people operate off of an MTV mentality. And so I'm trying to be one person to get agenda back into focus for Black people and other people too, in terms of where are the problems and how do we look at them and how might we talk about resolving them as a group.
Okay. Elaine Brown is our guest today on Conversations. The book she referred to is called A Taste of Power, A Black Woman's Story. It came out in 1992 in hardback, 1993 in paper?
Yeah. 1993, actually, in hardback.
Okay. In Anchor Doubleday has put it out in paper. Elaine Brown is our guest today on Conversations. I want to talk about that about your plans, about this education project you want to start. But to get there, let's get there more slowly, because I want to go through the what came to be known as the survival programs
right.
of the Panthers. The memory of the Panthers is, as you say, Huey Newton sitting in a rattan chair with a pump shotgun and a beret on. But Newton and later you and Bobby Seale started and pushed a tremendous number of what we would think of as, the phrase was survival programs. Talk about those for a while. How'd they come about?
The initial thing was the Free Breakfast for Children program, which became pretty well known across the country. And I think it's important to mention parenthetically, not so parenthetically in terms of the substance or how it played itself out, but that J. Edgar Hoover, when he made his famous statement that the Black Panther Party was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States, it had more to do with our programs, our social programs or survival programs, than with our guns, which he basically referred to as our puny guns. Because nobody in their right mind would have thought the Black Panther Party was going to take on the United States government and have revolution now.
Not enough weapons, not enough people, couldn't.
And not only that, what is it, a coup d'etat in the United States? I mean, let's talk realistically, you know. And what would we do, become the government? I mean, so there's all of that. That wasn't our goal. Our goal was to promote a mass effort and a mass revolution.
So
in order to do that,
programs?
We created these programs.
Good.
And in order to get people involved in this process, in other words, more people than people who were conscious, and you had to start at the level at which we felt people would understand. People are hungry. So if the government isn't providing, if there are no jobs for you, and the Black Panther Party comes along and says, here's the breakfast for free for your kids. They can't think when they go to school because they're hungry and blah, blah. And so now you start thinking about what's this Black Panther Party, and so it goes. And J. Edgar Hoover recognized that and felt that that was our real, that was the real danger of the Black Panther Party, was our ability to infect the rest of the masses of people with this notion of revolution through these various programs. And we did do that. And we not only did it in the Black community, we did it with alliances and coalitions with the Brown Berets, for example, White Patriot Party in Chicago, and Puerto Rican Socialist Party, and so forth, various groups of people. Repeated the same thing. So we did the breakfast program, which was simply free breakfast for children, mm-hmm. and they did have free breakfast. And then we did complete bags of food, you know, thousands and thousands of bags of food. We gave away Oakland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, and so forth. And we expanded that to healthcare in our clinics. We developed clinic programs, free clinics. People could come as alternative medicine. Mm-hmm. Not only that, preventive medicine program, something the healthcare industry in America doesn't even like to talk about today.
The Black Panthers brought the issue of sickle cell anemia to
right.
the nation's consciousness.
Right.
That's
and to the American Medical Association and to all the medical schools, because this was a disease that was peculiar to Black people, actually in America. Black people in Africa do have this disease, but don't die from it because of, you know, the environment and whatever else. But transporting it here, we do die. And so that was one other thing we did through the clinic program. And we had ambulances that would go into Black communities when ambulances wouldn't and still won't go into the Black communities. And we even had shoes. We had a shoe factory. We made shoes and we distributed them. Mm-hmm. So through these programs, excuse me, and a school, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Through these programs, we were able to be in contact with Black people who began to say, well, yes, if the Black Panther Party is doing this, we ought to have this. And they began to see the link between an economic system, not just a question of race, but an economic system and themselves. Why is it that we don't have food? And they began to ask questions, and we began to answer them. And that became our thrust. It was the main thrust. The guns were really in the background for defense and for perhaps a political statement here or there, mm-hmm. such as might have been made in the Rodney King case. But other than that, we concentrated on building these programs, and that ultimately led to the idea of not only controlling the food and so forth, but then we moved to housing. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to one city, Oakland, California.
Oakland, to solidify.
Yes.
Does this need to happen today?
Oh, absolutely. In my opinion. I think that there are communities, I mean, black people are living basically in ghettos, urban areas. I mean, we are in the South, but basically we've shifted over the two migrations from World War I and II to become an urban group. And that's where the big crime goes on. And that's where the big problems are in the urban centers of America, where black people occupy these, or as I say, we are cordoned off into these internment camps.
Is that why you smile?
I smile for what?
When you say that's where the crime goes on, that's where...
Well, that's where the center of... I don't smile. It's a cynical smile because...
That's what I mean, yeah.
That's where we are, in essence. I mean, generally speaking, of course, even Atlanta, but Atlanta has become an urban center as opposed to it's not a little sleepy town anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. But we are not in Mississippi in the numbers anymore. We're not in the backwoods anymore. You know, we're off the farm. We were in the factories for the First World War and Second World War, and then we lost that job and just became ghettoized. So I'm focusing on that, and I certainly think that we have to develop communities. I mean, in other words, what are the choices black people have right now? There is racism in America. Now, anybody who denies that, and I'm sure Clinton would, but there is racism in America, and it's profound and deep. We've had all these anti-discrimination laws, all of them been overturned or not implemented. We've had Brown versus Board of Education not implemented. As a matter of fact, a recent case, Pitts versus somebody, I can't remember the other part, 1994, Supreme Court said that segregation in schools was legal as long as it was based on residential patterns. We're back to square one. Mm-hmm. And not only that, I don't know what desegregation really meant in terms of education of black children or white children. But that's a separate issue. The point being that we occupy these little urban centers. So we had 27,000 black mayors because we were in the main, in these centers, in Los Angeles, New York, and so forth. Then came the big backlash, like sort of a Bakke in the urban centers, you know, and we all talked about reverse discrimination and problems of crime, and it's black people's fault that we're not, you know, that we're not, look at all the immigrants who come and look how well they're doing, and look at you people, you've been here all this time, and how come you're still committing crimes on welfare and so forth and so on. Right. But the fact is that America has shut black people out. I've never had a program since 1865 other than to free us as slaves. Then we had the Black Codes, the KKK, and then we had Plessy versus Ferguson, and we fought to desegregate America all the way through Martin Luther King, just to talk about getting on a bus and eating at a lunch counter. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an embarrassing scenario, but that's the story of black people in a nutshell. So my contention is simply that as the black community, we will have to be empowered, and we will have to take the urban centers where we are. Booker T. Washington said, drop our buckets where we are. So I'm saying we can seize these centers, make them our own, and make them work for ourselves. They are all and develop ourselves and empower ourselves, and later for worry about what the government does or anybody else does. But that doesn't mean we don't also challenge the existing scheme. But we've got to develop the power to even be able to make an effective challenge.
Okay, this is Elaine Brown, our guest today on Conversations. Now, bring us down to where you want to begin in Oakland. Tell me about the schools and why.
Well, I want to with another guy, another member, former member of the party, actually, and another man, sort of the three of us. I have an idea to sort of duplicate or replicate the school that we had in the education sense. That is to say, we had a magnificent school, the Black Panther Party.
Award-winning,
won all kinds of awards and stuff. Nobody could figure out what was the standard, how do we go above the standards and so forth. And it was very simple. We just took care of the children. That is to say, we took care of their basic fundamental needs. They ate three meals a day at our school. We bought clothing for them. We took care of their health care. We had eye checks because we found out sometimes people couldn't read because they couldn't see. Whoa, that was really, you know. So we did all of that. And care, and by the time we got our children in these small class arrangements, it was very easy to teach them. So I will do that structural thing in Oakland again. But that's sort of one part of it. The second part of the education plan is to take these children from 2 to 14 years old and get them basically finished and ready for college at 14 or maybe beyond already, because I think there's a lot of wasted energy going on in some of the public school systems. The purpose of all this is to present a model, an alternative. So somebody might say, well, gee, I could do that. And I'm hoping somebody will say that, you know, such as the public school system in America. So that's the educational element. The other part of the educational element would be to say, I want these children to be prepared for a future life, not to be prepared to be little soldier workers and get a job at IBM or on the factory, but the factory jobs are finished. Mm-hmm. Those are dead. They're all going out with NAFTA to wherever, you know, in the world. So the real jobs, working for companies that exploit other people, I'm trying to get away from that also. But there aren't even those jobs for black people or white people. IBM talking about cutting back 31,000 jobs in 1994. That's it. They're not coming back, those 31,000 jobs. All these people that got master's degrees and thought they would be computer experts and work for IBM, they're finished. That day is over. So I want to direct these children's attention toward what they want to do and then make that work in a productive way. So, for example, remember when you were a kid and you looked at fish and you thought, gee, I'd like to know more about what's under the sea? But everybody said, are you an idiot? Get a job, learn to type, or whatever else. Mm-hmm. I want to show them, I want to take that creativity and I want to develop it because I think that's the purpose of education. As opposed to developing soldier workers who will get up and sit at their desk at 9 o'clock so they can remember to do that when they get to the factory at 9 o'clock.
Creative
energy, productive energy, and also consciousness that you are not the only person on the planet, mm-hmm. and that you do not need to work for money, but the money will come. It will come. I mean, where are all of our alternative energy systems, okay? There are a million of them out there already, but nobody's developed them because they're bucking the gas company and the electric company who can't figure out how to take over solar energy. If they could, then they'd sell you solar energy. So, but there are other systems and there are other things. So I want these children not only to understand basics. I mean, if you can't read and write by the time you're 3 or 4 years old, Jesus Christ, this is easy to do. Easy. Mm-hmm. Easy stuff. We can get rid of that right away. Now I want to move on to big stuff. I want to get on to new kinds of technologies that are useful for human beings. I'll give you a quick example. 20,000 people last year, I believe, were fired or lost their jobs in the timber cutting industry in Washington State or whatever, wherever they're cutting timber. And the environmentalists say, we want to save the owl. And the timber workers say, well, gee, we want to keep our jobs and we don't know how to do anything else. Well, you've been working in the forest for all these years. Did it ever occur to anybody to save the trees and use these timber people to become environmental protection people and nature lovers and maybe discover a few things in the forest that might be beneficial to people or about animals and so forth? I mean, it's amazing to me that nobody figured this out. Mm-hmm. I want to do that in the school. Mm-hmm. I want little black children, Mexican children, poor white children, whoever's going to be in this school to say, I don't want to necessarily work for IBM. I may not want to be a doctor or a lawyer, but I do. Maybe I like to be in the forest, and maybe I can do some really interesting work there. And I want to support that, and I want to give them a base for thinking that they can do that and that they can live and make a living from doing that. Of course, that means a bigger shift outside, but we'll get to that in a minute. They've got to at least be prepared to think of themselves as productive, humane, and caring people in the future, and they've got to have a base of education for that. That's the educational part. Mm-hmm. You want me to talk about the rest?
Of course I do.
Okay, the other second element is that housing. People need housing. You're living with a crack mother. You don't need to go home every day. That's the end of that. Or maybe you're a mother and you really can't deal with trying to get through the neighborhood every day or get your kid to school. So I want to have housing units where either mothers and children, I'm using single mothers, I don't really, you know, after that, it's not my, I can't be responsible for everything. But for now, we'll talk single mothers and students mm-hmm. in a sort of a dormitory, but I don't want these to look like dormitories. I hate institutional buildings. And so I'm trying to create something really beautiful and exotic, and also that the community will feel like it's a community now, not a ghetto. Yeah. Have a swimming pool, all those kinds of things. Just a beautiful building. And then the third element is what I call cooperative enterprise outlets. So, for example, the children either in the neighborhood or the children in the school or a combination of them can begin to develop a small business, but in a cooperative ownership worker relationship. That is to say, you're the owner, you're the worker, and you're the distributor, and you make the profit, and you split it up, and it's real easy. So maybe we'll start with, I always say shoes, because everybody's killing each other in LA over Nikes or in Oakland over Nikes. Mm. worrying about whether Air Jordan, what Air Jordan somebody's got. I'm paying $200 a piece, ripping off somebody for the $200. My suggestion is, why don't you just make them charge $50? You make a profit. You're the worker. You're the owner. And you're the distributor. Easy. I mean, it's a concept. And the concept is also a model for an alternative way of thinking about economic relationships. That is to say, people can have small businesses in cooperation with each other, do the right thing, sell the right kinds of products. There's nothing wrong with profit. It's something wrong with exploitation for profit. Make a profit, share it, make a good product. Have a farm. I would like to have a farm connected with this. Mm-hmm. Have a farm. Farm your vegetables. Have the outlet at the school. Sell the vegetables. Decent food, not sprayed, not whatever. Decent prices, because you can do it, because you are the middleman. And so you can make the prices normal. Mm-hmm. And plus, you might get rid of Safeway and Nike in the process, at least for that community. That's the idea. And it's to build the concept within these three elements, well, the two elements, the school and the businesses, that we have to take charge of our lives because nobody's coming to get us. Nobody's coming anymore. That's been clear since 1865, but it ought to be clear in 1994 when Clinton makes a statement that he wants to get rid of welfare, statements that George Bush couldn't even get away with, that he's going to present a crime bill and lock up everybody. We all know that means young black men. That he's got a crime bill. He marches from Monticello. It was an insulting thing at the inauguration. Clinton is looking more and more like Bush to me. I thought I was voting not Bush, and he comes out looking like Bush. So I'm just saying that's the last white hope we had. And that's fizzling and dying every minute, but it ought to, because we need to take charge of our lives and empower ourselves. But I'm not talking about black capitalism. I'm not talking about buy black. I'm talking about having a mass movement and a mass involvement where everybody is a leader and everybody is a follower and everybody is a worker and everybody is an owner, and I think it can work.
The revolution is not over.
Absolutely not. Not for me.
Are you starting this small or big? This is a huge project.
It's small, but it's a big project. It's a small thing because it doesn't, I mean, Oakland, you know, what is it, 400,000 people? Mm-hmm. It's not a big number when you're talking about 250 million people in the United States. Or 40-some million black people. We never know how many we are because the census always changes depending on the need of the numbers. But basically, black people, this is one project. I mean, I would like to do this in every community, in every urban center in America. I would like to change the relationship with the public school system. It's critical that we have education. We can't go forward. We don't have a future with a group of people who think I only can choose between McDonald's and drug sales. I don't want to be shot over $2 worth of crack. Mm-hmm. And I can be. You know, much as I love my people, somebody's supposed to mistake me for somebody they were mad at the other day, you know. And I know why they're mad, but I want to get them out of that pattern, and I want to offer them the opportunity and the alternative. And I do it with a model. I can't save the world, but I can create an idea in concrete, and that's the idea.
Elaine Brown with us on Conversations. The book is called A Taste of Power. It begins in North Philadelphia with Elaine and her mom, who raised Elaine not to live in the ghetto. She raised her child taking piano lessons and going to good schools and lifted her up literally at your mom's expense in her own life. But she wanted better for her child. The result is a woman who, as you hear, has lots of dreams and the ability to act. The book, A Taste of Power, takes a look at her life as a child and then her life with the Black Panther Party. It ends in 1977 when she fled the party for a safer life for herself and for Erica Brown, her own child. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. During Elaine Brown's tenure as head of the Panthers, she expanded its community work, enlarging the free breakfast program and creating what we've talked about in this half hour, the award-winning Oakland Community Learning Center in one of Oakland's poorest neighborhoods. She ran twice for public office in Oakland, never made it to the Oakland City Council, but negotiated successfully with the city government and with the state government to make sure that a freeway project provided jobs for people in Oakland and did not destroy, but in fact enlivened the community of Oakland while it was being built. This is Conversations. We're talking today with Elaine Brown. I want to keep talking about your education, et cetera, project as it is, but kind of move around it if we can. There are sociologists and other thinkers, both black and white, who say that an entire generation of, especially of black, but also of Latin American kids in America, is gone, will never come into any kind of interaction with the larger community, don't stand a chance to really live in America in the course of their lives. What do you think about that? Is there a wasted generation, a lost generation because of poverty, cocaine, stuff?
There is a difficult problem, and I think that's what they're talking about. It would take another generation just to repair and undo. But, you know, when Lincoln freed the slaves, as it was called, in 1863, as you know, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, but remember that he said, I'm freeing the slaves in the seceding states. That is to say, you could have a slave if you were in one of the states and wanted to stick with the Union. So slavery was not even abolished with Lincoln. And Lincoln was faced with a big problem in his mind, and he actually articulated this problem in 1862 to a group of five blacks that came to the White House, first time any blacks had been in the White House. And he said, look, your people are uncomfortable with me, and with our people, and frankly, we're uncomfortable with you. And it would be better for both of us if we were separated. At that time, he tried to send black people. He was finished with the slave program because he knew he had to move from agrarian society to an industrial-based economy. So the slave economy was not really important anymore to the northern industrialists that Lincoln essentially represented. So he had to get rid of all this slave labor, because what are you going to do with all these 11 million people who can't read or write, who can't function anywhere, and whom you don't like? Send them back to Africa. But he didn't get the money together to send them back to Africa. So he thought about Haiti and he thought about Cuba, and then the war was going on, South was winning, things got bad. So he just said, well, we're freeing these slaves, gets them out of the farms, because they got the message right away, left the farms, joined the Union Army despite Lincoln's opposition, two blacks being in the Union Army at the time. And the war was won, that was the end of that. From 1865, 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, so-called slave amendments of the U.S. Constitution, to this minute, nobody in America has known what to do with black people. We've been a slave group. It's a hell of a thing to try to get all these people up to speed. You know what I mean? Here you are. Well, Jesus Christ, you can't. You never learned how to read or write. We didn't bother putting schools together for you. We didn't assimilate you, and we don't want you here, but you're free. So what were we? Sort of a wandering group of nobodies. Then you had Marcus Garvey come along saying, let's go back. Let's get out of this mess. Mm-hmm. And then you had this minute of Liberia, whatever that was. But basically, we've been here with no place to be. So it's kind of bizarre to identify this one generation as lost when there have been many generations lost, okay?
I see.
Because it costs a lot of money to bring people into the system. But the real thing is you have to have the will to want them into the system. Now, poor whites aren't even in the system. So you know down on the totem pole, it's going to cost a lot of money. Now, in the 1960s, there was something called, under Johnson, when Johnson was president, there was something called the Iron Mountain Report. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It became a book. Johnson said it wasn't true. And the Iron Mountain Report was a group of sociologists and economists who got together to say, in order to maintain the status quo, what do we need to do? And one of the questions was, what do we need to do about black people who were draining the welfare rolls, large percentage in prison, as we have today, so forth. And they concluded that the only way, that it would cost more money up to the year 2000 to re-educate and re-and assimilate this mass of people than to just get rid of them. And they actually proposed that without an emotional thing. And of course, Johnson therefore rejected it because the conclusion was pretty ugly. Mm-hmm. Johnson, of course, comes out with the poverty program, which is really a program for black people, which was, you know, at least an acknowledgement there was a problem. But I don't think that this generation is any more lost than a whole bunch of, I mean, where are these black people doing anything so significant in the big wide world anyway? I mean, do we think because we got Oprah Winfrey and Michael Jacksons and Jordans and all these other people that this represent? We had Sidney Poitier. I'm not impressed. We had Sidney Poitier at one time. We had Lena Horne, you know. But these are aberrations. They have nothing to do with the mass of black people. We have had generation after generation. My mother is 78 years old. She was a presser in a factory. She's living on Social Security today. She worked 3 jobs. She doesn't have anything. She just wasn't on drugs. But I have girlfriends who had their babies, the first baby at 13, and all the rest of them had 8 of them. They're on welfare now, you see? So I don't know that this is a particularly lost generation, but what it really reflects, I think, is that there's no will to do anything about this situation. So, but even if you want to discount this whole entire group of people who will not go away, other than they will die off, you're not going to be able to put them in prison. It's going to cost you too much to put them all in prison. You're not going to be able to put them all in boot camp. It's ineffective and too expensive. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do? You can talk about how difficult it is, but you've got to do something. My something is, I'm going to create these little businesses. And I've talked to these guys from the Bloods and the Crips who represent that group that we're talking about. And they want to do something in their lives. I saw an interview, lastly on this, I saw an interview that a documentary film put together by a white guy, a filmmaker. And he interviewed some guys in the gangs in L.A. because everybody's fascinated with them. And there was one guy, and I mean, he was, you know, buffed up, done his prison time in and out so many times, 20-some years old. And I swear to you that he said, well, what do you want to do in your life? He said, we're tired of having gang war. We're trying to have a truce here. We know the drugs are bad, but we don't have anything. He said, what did you ever want to do? And I swear to you, this guy said, well, I like to garden. Now did anybody ever ask these people what they ever wanted to do?
Yeah.
Did you ever think of them, not you, but did anybody ever think of them as having a human, having a real face and a real idea and a real desire? I mean, just yesterday, they were little, you know, little Joey on the street. And now they're, you know, little Joey with a gun. But they had an idea and a dream, too, just like everybody else. I think you can tap that because they're tired of killing each other, too. But they don't have any options, and the Clinton administration offers them nothing, and the society is writing them off. I'm saying I'm going to create an option or an idea of an option. And that can happen. And I talked to those guys, and I said, could you do it? Would 5 of you get together and make some shoes and do this? You got a distribution network because you're distributing coke right now. You know what I mean? I know you got a distribution network. So you know how to get out there and do that. Mm-hmm. They're hustling. They're working every day. It's work. You know, you got to keep the competition off. And you know what they said? Yes. It hadn't even occurred to them. But so if somebody like me and some other people like me would just... What's a shoe machine cost? A couple $1,000 or something? Set up a little shop, start with 5, get some others. People will be proud. They'll be happy. They'll buy the shoes. And it begins to put an idea in your head that there aren't just those options and that I can't be written off because there are people who want to live and they're in gangs and they have guns and they're dealing coke. And they too want to live and they're tired. Last little thing on this, if I can.
Sorry.
This cocaine business. The insult of all of that conversation to me is, we all know now from testimony from the United States Senate, John Kerry held hearings in 1987, that the Medellin cartel was asked by the Oliver North Group to give $10 million and did give $10 million, at least in that one period, to the Contras. We know that the cocaine is coming in here because the United States government has either turned its head or encouraged this flow because it's got a use for the people in Nicaragua, in Panama. We know that Noriega was on the CIA payroll while he was trafficking drugs, and CIA when it was headed by George Bush under a Ford. So that 15-year period that you're talking about is the 15-year period when the drug flow came into America like bombs away, and that was all working through Central America when we had the death squads in El Salvador, supported, we know now, by the Reagan administration. When you had the Contras in Nicaragua, which we know now supported by the Oliver North Group under various administrations and so forth, and Panama, drug trafficking through Panama, coming out of Colombia, and all these things tied into the United States government at the highest levels. So the insult of this whole generation being lost, that generation is lost because those drugs did come in, And these people were so desperate, and there was money to be made in them, their drugs, you know. And there were, and people were also tired, and they were in pain, so they took drugs. So you had a distribution, and it was a wonderful way of saying, we keep our Noriegas in place, we keep our Contras in place, we dump these drugs on the blacks and the poor and the rest of those people. And look, it's a win-win situation, except for now you've created this monster that nobody wants to deal with.
Elaine Brown, with us on Conversations. Can a program that creates education, hope, and small economic centers, or small agrarian centers, depending on what the thrust is, compete against an open tap of drugs coming into communities all over the United States?
Or Pepsi-Cola. Or can it compete with Pepsi-Cola, for example? You know what I mean? In other words, there's
translate.
In other words, Pepsi-Cola is a big company. Can it compete with these global and these massive corporations any more than the drugs? I'm not worried. Oakland is even known as Cokeland, you know. It's so bad, the cocaine. But these guys are not as organized as people think. A lot of them are in competition, okay? And a lot of them are going to jail, and a lot of them are tired. And I'm not trying to compete with them. I won't even deal with them. I'm not dealing with a drug program. I don't have that kind of... I mean, somebody that does drug programs can do drug programs.
Right.
And
right.
I'm hoping they will. I will have a small health unit attached to this school, you know, a little clinic or something. But I'm not, I don't want to do a drug program because I can't do that. And it's not forward moving. It's just repairing. And I don't want to do that because this is what I'm doing. Okay. Other people can do that.
Okay. There are going to be people listening to us today who will be saying in their own minds, this woman's got a good idea.
Yeah, how, a lot of people have said that.
Are there nuts and bolts, or how are you going to get your funding, or if you were to say to someone, if you were to say to someone, you can do this,
you can.
What would you say to them? How to get started?
Well, I'm just begging for the money. I mean, I don't want government money. I'm doing my best to stay around that because I don't want their involvement, and I don't want them to take credit for what I'm doing because then. They will not repair the school system but pretend they've got some alternative system or something else. I want this to be a program for a mass public education. In other words, I'm not trying to create an alternative, I'm trying to create a model for mass education and use the numbers of the expenses to show that I can spend the same money or less and get better results and have everybody happier and all that. So I would just say what I said to people have asked me this question. It is a good idea, but what this idea does is what it's triggering people to say, what can we do? Wow, that's a new thing already. Mm-hmm. It's already triggered that. Mm-hmm. Just by hearing me talk about something that doesn't even exist yet. So what I think has to happen in Fairbanks is what people in Fairbanks want to happen. I don't know the particulars here. I know Oakland, I know LA, and I know Philadelphia. But I don't even know Chicago, for example. Mm-hmm. And there are particulars that do affect how you behave and what you have to do. I mean, there's snow here. I mean, it has a lot to do, environment has everything to do with how people can organize or do whatever they have to do. It's not, you know, L.A. where you're going to get these riots because it's hot.
Right.
If it was that cold, you wouldn't have had that Rodney King operation in L.A. It's just a simple fact of life. So I think you've got to look at what your needs are and what you want to do. But yes, you can do it. How am I getting the money? I happen to be in a very good position. I'm some of the money for my book, a large part of the money for my book and what money I make from speaking. But this is a drop in the bucket, but I'm doing that for good faith, and also because there and I know I'm stuck because I don't want to lose my money. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I don't want, you know, I don't have $20,000, $30,000 to blow. So if I put up $30,000, it's just a token, but it's a token that's very significant for me. Mm-hmm. I'm in a good position right now in my personal life that I don't have to deal with that day-to-day battle that a lot of other people have to deal with. And there are people like that out there like me.
Right.
A few little blacks with a little bit of money who can... you know, manipulate the world a little bit better than others can. Mm-hmm. And then I'm just going out and I'm hustling right now. I'm trying to find some foundation money. And then when I get a little bit, and I've got some other private individuals that I'm tapping into, hard for people to come off of money, you know. They talk a good game. But if five people just give me $50,000, I have $250,000, which would get me started on my architectural design. But I need a million. Just to get started. But then I'm going to go to all the big stars, all the big Negroes. Oh, I shouldn't say that on television, should I? I'm going to go to all those people, and I'm going to say, look, you wanted to do something. You've been saying, I don't know what to do with all these millions of dollars. You know, that $36 million I made off that Pepsi contract last year. I've given to the United Negro College Fund. Mm-hmm. And so that's it. You know, that's enough. And I'm going to give them an opportunity to do something very quick, very concrete, and very serious, because most of these kids that I'm talking about never going to get to the United Negro Colleges to get their money. They're not making it to the colleges, you know. The majority of them not going to Lincoln and Spelman and Morehouse and so forth. Mm-hmm. The lucky ones get there. Mm-hmm. And they're probably already taken care of anyway at home, you know. And so I'm talking about the ones that are not even going to get to think about, didn't even know there was a historically black college, you know. And I'm giving them an opportunity to go down in history as having done the right thing, and just as opposed to just making money off of Pepsi ads and Nike ads and whatever other stuff they're doing. And I think they're going to like that. And so I'm just begging for the money. And I became a professional beggar in the Black Panther Party. I know how to beg for money. You know, I know how to get the dollars transferred over there. I just needed to get my own personal life in order to put this level of energy out. There's no Black Panther Party. I'm not a leader. I'm just doing a thing right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to create a model for an idea that I hope will be concretized over and over and over again.
Elaine Brown with us on Conversations. She was born, is it all right if I say when? Oh,
go right ahead.
Thank you. In 1943 in North Philadelphia. She's been in Fairbanks on this, her only trip to the Arctic.
My only trip to the Arctic.
I'm so sorry.
Not at all. Not to the Arctic. First of all, I've been to Anchorage several times.
Yes.
And I have been fishing in King Salmon, if you can believe that.
How'd you do?
Well, it wasn't the greatest thing. I went with somebody who loves fishing. But
okay.
But anyway, so incredible. We're throwing back the salmon, people hungry. But anyway, I don't even want to talk about that part. But the other thing is, I've also been to the Kola Peninsula several times.
So sorry.
You see.
Never make assumptions. This is what we've just learned today.
But Fairbanks, yeah. I have to tell you, is the first time.
It's the first. She's here to visit friends. And she's talked with community groups. And the night before this taping, as we speak, the night before this taping, gave a lecture and discussion to people on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus.
Yeah.
Elaine Brown with us today on Conversations. This is an unanswerable question, so just pick whatever part of it works for you. How did you become this woman who can lead a major party, fight with for city and state officials for a better deal for her community, write a book, raise a kid on your own, decide you're not done with this revolution and come back and make a new start with a whole new project, which is has monumental optimism attached to it and plans to it. What made this woman so self-confident? You said friends of yours had babies at 13 and 14. Kids dropped out and fell out all over the place.
Yeah. I honestly, and as you say, it's unanswerable because all the little pieces of everybody's life form who we are and our responses to things. And plus, I'm a very insecure person, even though a lot of people don't believe that. You know, personally, I, you know, sometimes feel like, well, as a matter of fact, a lot of the time, I'm not sure. But then when I get on an idea, I get really, my enthusiasm wipes out my fear, personal fear, because it's not about me anymore. But I think that the foundation of that is very clear. Isn't that ironic? It was in the schools that I went to. Because my mother believed I was a ghetto princess, you know. And there I was, as you say, taking ballet lessons and piano lessons and all of this. But what I did when I stepped out of that ghetto, stepped outside the ghetto, I saw there was a world outside of the ghetto. And that had a tremendous impact on my life, as it does on a lot of people's lives who get beyond a very narrow a narrow environment or a narrow universe. I saw that there was life outside the ghetto, because it was certainly not life in the ghetto, but I didn't know that. I mean, it was just the only life I knew, like a lot of other black children. But I went outside for a minute, and I saw that there was a world. And of course, initially, I wanted to be a part of that world. I was ready to quit the ghetto in 10 minutes. It didn't take me much to figure out it was better to live, you know, in the white world of my friends than where I was living, mm-hmm. you know, in a very concrete way, refrigerators with food in them. So, I mean, it's not very, you know, complicated. But I also saw that, and so that was an incredible put desire into my heart. And I began to think that I ought not be in the ghetto. Now, I found that this was true of Huey Newton and Bunchy Carter and a whole lot of us. Mm-hmm. There was a common thread in this. Huey Newton, for example, was the seventh son of his mother. He was a really special son, and his mother, not the other children, but him, because she was from Louisiana and there was some, you know, mystical relationship between the seventh son. Mm-hmm. And so she taught him that he was a special kid. Now, if you're special, you don't accept nothing. So now how are you going to make that all work out? Well, you could become, you know, Mr. First Integrated Harvard Law Person.
Yeah.
But if you're growing up in the ghetto, you begin to have some other ideas because you have come from a street thing, too. And, I mean, many people said to me, well, why didn't you go to school and become, like, a lawyer or something or whatever else? It never even occurred to me to do that because then I got the drill. But Bunchy Carter, same thing, took dance lessons. Here he was in the gang, leader of a gang.
5,000 in his gang.
5,000.
Huge gang in Los Angeles.
Yeah, Slauson. Mm. People still in prison from the Slauson. But was one of something like 8 or 9 children. Special kid, though. Took tap dancing lessons. Was a great swimmer. Nobody thinks black people can even swim. Was a swimming competition. Was a special person. John Huggins, same thing. Went to the Boston Latin School. Erica Huggins, same thing. You know, mm-hmm. And if you go through all of us, you find there's this one thread. And I've done this in my mind. I mean, not all, but there's a general thread of all of us being brought up by our parents to imagine that we were somebody. And once you do that and the world says you're not, well, you got to fight it, mm-hmm. you know? In other words, it's not a question of being free. I'm already free. What are you doing being in my way? You know, when you're the princess, what do you mean I'm black? I know, I was just taught I was the queen. I was just a princess, I was the queen. I was wearing my dresses, my ballet lessons. And so I really thought I was a person of value until the entire world knocked me down and told me I was nothing. And I really was hurt by that. Mm-hmm. And when I found the Black Panther Party and its program for sweeping everything out of the way and starting again, it was my program. It wasn't hard to make that decision, you see. So after that, everything just fell into place. Going to girls' high school, where I went to school, all girls' school, very elitist, where, of course, my friend Perry Rafsky, that's the name I know, Perry Gilmore, who teaches here, whom I came to visit here, mm-hmm. And I knew each other. One of the things that did, even though it was an elitist school, predominantly white, it had subtle racism because the intellectuals are too smart to be overtly racist. But the best thing was it was all women. So there was another link to that. I had a sense that in the critical period of my life, between 14 and 18, I never saw men in dominant positions. There were no men in my neighborhood, that was for sure. And in the school I went to, women were the head of everything. Women were everything. And so we all knew, we assumed we would be the editor of the paper. Oh my God, somebody else became. But we didn't think of ourselves as women battling a man to become that. We were all women. So we obviously took leadership roles. So that. And I tell you, and everybody would laugh, or people would laugh if they thought that, but I know that my training for a leadership role
right.
in the Black Panther Party came from this very elitist white school, Girls High, because it never occurred to me that I couldn't be a leader, because Girls High taught its daughters to be leaders. It didn't teach us to be housewives. We were taught to be leaders.
Well, there were women in the Black Panther Party, but the men, there's this incredible story in the book about someone coming and saying to you, can we have some money to go buy dinner at a gathering? The girls, you women giving money, the dinner coming back, and then you standing up to stand in line for dinner and someone saying, the warriors eat first, get out of the way.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I couldn't fight that situation because, see, there's one thing about, see, an enemy with no gun is not very much of an enemy. You know what I mean?
True.
You can hate me. I don't care. You know what I mean? I care if you have a gun. Then I care. These guys were armed. Well, this wasn't in the Black Panther Party, that incident that you described. This was a Krangers Us organization.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And they were, you know, into trying to prove them. They're mostly college students into a macho thing, trying to be very black, and also trying to be black, knowing they were getting ready to go off and work at white, you know, things. So this was like a reaction. You find a lot of black people, middle class blacks, do that. They tend to be overly black to compensate for their life that they feel guilty about and all of this, you know. But that was very, you know, that happened. And I challenged it then because I came from a street thing. You know, and I looked at these guys as being kind of little middle class guys. So I came from just, in that particular scenario, I thought of it as a street thing. I wasn't accustomed to anybody speaking to me that way.
It's interesting that the princess was pretty
also
tough.
On the street. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I had to be everything. I had to be white at school and Jewish, as a matter of fact, which I was all the way. I mean, I was exactly that person. And on the street, I was kind of like, you know, pretty tough, as I had to be, not necessarily all the time. But, you know, I could stand my own. On the street, a lot of it is just about attitude, you know.
Yeah.
And my goal was just not to get my face cut during the period of my life. These were the big goals you had, you know. And in the house, I was a little princess in my mother's eyes.
Has it taken effort to integrate all those
Absolutely.
People and find out kind of who Elaine is?
7 years of therapy.
Oh.
Absolutely. I still had all those dualities. But, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois talks about the duality that all black people experience living in the white, being black living in a white world. And so I think that, in a general sense, I fall into that same category. A lot of black people who've read my book say, I wanted to be white too, but I didn't want to ever tell anybody. Huh. You know? And there is that. We do live in that world. We do have to, we don't know what to do with ourselves. We're not a people in the sense of, we don't have a territory that we can say, this is our land. You know, what is our land? We don't know. Africa, what is it? It's a continent, you know. We don't have a language that is our native language. Our native language is English, you know. So we have a real problem as a people just in general living in this, and that certainly applied to me. And I began to sense that I was crazy from the beginning, as I describe in my book. Mm-hmm. And the Black Panther Party sort of resolved that it gave me a definite identity and a definite place to be, among the other things that I found in the Black Panther Party. And when I left, I was stripped of that. And that's when I went to therapy, and I had to go back
start over again
all that territory and figure out how to blend my white voice, my black voice, my likes of this, my dislikes of that, and who I was, and all that identity stuff, personal identity stuff. And now, I'm okay with all of it, you know.
What's the key?
You know, it's like I'm not a man or a woman. I'm a plain-born child. I'm not a child. I'm not black. I'm not white. I'm black for the social purposes of America, you know. And I've been a victim of being a black person. But I'm more, just like everybody else, a person on the planet.
Black is not a matter of color.
It is a matter of color. It's just not a matter of race. It doesn't have any real value, in other words. It has no negative value or no positive value. It's just you are black. I mean, any more than being white has a value. It has a social value. It gets a pretty heavy social value. But it doesn't have an intrinsic value any more than, you know, anything else has an intrinsic value. And there's no innate quality of black.
Mm-hmm.
Any more than there would be of African American, whatever that's supposed to be, mm-hmm. or colored when we were colored, or Negro when we were Negro. You know, there's no intrinsic, innate value or a value. What value? I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you value black versus white in the real world? I mean, if you've got two eyes and they're pretty much in the same place, and nose and lips and all that stuff. So, I mean, you know, we're talking about minor differences of hair, shades of color, and, you know, height, and, you know, they're very, very minor differences. And they do not fall into any racial category. So race is a real non-issue in the real world. But we have to deal with race because, unfortunately, In this country, race is an issue, or as Cornel West said, race does matter. It matters mm-hmm. in America. Mm-hmm. So I have to describe myself as a black person. I have to, people identify me, and people even say, in America is a credible thing. I live in France now. In America, the first thing people say, is he white? Or do you talk to someone and say, hey, was he black? Was she white? People really speak about race in America incredibly more than any other country in the world, because we've had this history that we've been in denial about and haven't acknowledged and come to grips with this whole slavery culture and this whole racial question, so we still pretend we don't have it, and so we have it even more. But I like to think of myself in the big, large world, very difficult to do, as a human being on the planet. And I've learned to balance all of these different elements into becoming Elaine Brown, a person that I like for the first time in a long time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's the healthiest place for you to be.
Yeah. I'm pretty happy with everybody right now, except people that are against other human beings mm-hmm. or they're doing things against. But in other words, I don't have a racial attitude. I don't have a gender attitude, a sexuality attitude, or any of that stuff. And it makes me really bored to hear that we're talking about homosexuals in the Army or not. I'm trying to figure out what anybody wants to be in the Army, first of all. Mm-hmm. Or we're talking about gender questions. I mean, these questions are bizarre if you really think about it. I mean, here we are in 1994, highly technological society, all this industry, all this money, all this power, all these guns, and we're talking about whether or not we should have homosexuals in the Army or whether or not women should get equal pay. I mean, think about it. This is rather barbaric, actually. So it irritates me, and it irritates me to hear about it, that this has become so important mm-hmm. to people, but we have to deal with it because, unfortunately, people are oppressed because they're women. They are oppressed because of their sexuality. They are oppressed because of their color, their religion, and so forth. I mean, I just can't believe we human beings are still having these conversations. It's incredible. So me, I'm well with myself, because I'm finished with that conversation. I'm on the future. I'm on marine biology. You know what I mean? Let's get some food for the people, figure out how to deal with nature, fit ourselves into it. Is there life on the other planets? Here's where I am in my heart of hearts, but I've got to, you know, deal with the real world too.
Elaine Brown, thank you for a very interesting hour.
Thank you very much. I'm sure I overtalked, but
no,
I warned you. Thank you for inviting me.
Forewarned is forearmed. My pleasure. I'm Susan McGinnis. We've spent the last hour with Elaine Brown. If you're interested in finding out more, keep an eye on Oakland, California to see what grows from the seeds she's planting. If you're interested in looking back with Elaine Brown, A Taste of Power, published in 1993 by Anchor Doubleday, is available at your bookstores in paperback. Stay with me every week on Conversations. Thanks for joining me. I hope you tune in again. Thanks, Elaine.
It was wonderful.